I'm in a glass case of emotion.
Hey, welcome to Cinema Sessions, the podcast where film fanatics who happen to also be therapists geek out about their favorite films, sharing therapeutic insights, character deep dives, and a healthy portion of non-clinical nonsense. My name is Rick Gutterson, and I'm joined today by my wonderful friend and co-host, Kayla Tuttle. How are you doing today?
You know, a feeling is hard to capture in a feeling word, but I feel like I've just strolled down memory lane with this movie.
Was the stroll, like what kind of pace did you stroll down? Was it an aggressive stroll? Was it a casual stroll?
No, it was very, very slow, very mindful, very like taken aback to all the memories.
Oh man, this film is so nostalgic, but I don't know how. I think I saw it once 20 years ago, but yet we are jumping into the movie A Walk to Remember. This came out in 2002, I believe. Kayla, I've had a lot of films that I was giddy to talk about. This, I feel like when you shared that you wanted to talk about this movie, like how to describe your giddiness in wanting to like break this movie down.
Yeah, I don't, it's just one of those movies that really resonated with me. And I don't even know if I can like quite put my finger on the pulse of why. I think the music has a lot to do with it. I really like the music. It might've been that at the time when this came out, I had a crush on the guy that plays Landon. He was pretty cute. Maybe that had something to do with it.
I could see that. I have to be honest, Kayla. When I saw him in this movie, not only did he look like a vampire, but also like I looked up his IMDb, which we'll maybe talk about a little bit more, but he literally before this movie starred in a vampire movie.
Which vampire movie?
Dracula 2000.
Oh, okay. I know he's in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I remember watching that. I think that came out after, but yeah, I mean, that's my type, right? Like pale, lanky.
He has some Edward vibes.
I like watching you sleep.
He does. That is my type, as you know.
Well, and my type is 1999 female pop singers. Mandy Moore is, man, this soundtrack, like you said, just takes me back. It's just, I used to listen to the soundtrack all the time for some reason.
So good. What happened to her? Like, does she still have a musical career?
I don't think so, but I didn't really, because I've never seen the show, which is, it seems like a show tailor-made for me, but she's a star in the show This Is Us.
Yes, I did watch some of that with her, but other than that, I haven't really seen her do much. I think with her, it seems like she kind of got pigeonholed into the Christian market, like that sort of thing. Like we talked about Saved a little bit. I remember talking about like that on an episode, and she was in that. But yeah, other than that, like, she was such a great singer. I don't really know what happened to that part of her career.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And we'll jump more into that in a little bit. Thanks for checking out this episode. We're really excited to dive into this 2002 movie. We're going to be covering a few different types of topics in addition to just talking about this this odd love-hate relationship, how it's an amazing movie and also a terrible movie. I can't wait to explore that more. Also, we'll talk about like the relationship dynamics because there's some really fascinating things I'm curious to get your opinion about, Kayla, about just does this relationship actually work in real life? And putting ourselves in her shoes and exploring that bad boy, you know, kind of thing. I want to talk about that. We're also going to talk about, these are a little bit of spoilers. So 1 second.
Hey, come on. I haven't seen it yet.
It doesn't have anything to do with the plot.
Still, I like to go in fresh.
If you haven't seen this movie, it's hard to talk about some of the therapy themes in this film. So this is your 3 second warning.
It's been 20 years. So
right?
I think they've had time by now.
Yes. So we're going to be diving into the topic of terminal illness and how you cope with that individually, and also the anticipatory grief that it creates for other people around us. And so that's a major portion of the second half of this film that if you don't know that that's what this film is about, could be a major spoiler. And so I wanted to kind of give a warning there. But I encourage you to follow us on either Apple, Spotify, any of those platforms. That would be super helpful. And you can check out our Instagram page. It's Cinema Sessions Pod at Instagram. We post little video clips and a lot of fun things like that. So really excited to talk into this. I'm going to speak into it like it's a megaphone. Talk about this film, Walk to Remember. So one of the things that's really kind of a theme in the second half of this movie, and even early on in the movie, you just don't understand why, is this idea of bucket lists, which then leads me to my curious question.
Excuse me, I have a few more questions if you don't mind.
Kayla, have you ever thought about a bucket list? If so, what's something that would be on your bucket list?
Oh, I've thought about this a lot. I'm a very existential kind of person of like, what is life about? What is meaning? What is purpose? Like, okay, what, you know, defines my life? My husband and I love to travel. So like highlighting some of those things has always been really important. I've actually thought about this recently. I think just like in the midst of like, my life is about to change. I'm about to become a mom. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you start to think about like where you've been, where you want to go, the things still left kind of to do on your list of living. One that I think would be really awesome would be to attend a red carpet premiere of a movie. That's just something I've always wanted to do.
Oh man, that is a great one.
Yeah.
I love that idea. Would you get all glammed up?
Oh yeah.
That would be amazing. I would, that to go out into Hollywood and to go to one of the huge premieres, walk the red carpet and just be a part of that initial experience would just be so fun.
Right. I mean, I know a lot of Hollywood people are listening. So the next film premiere you want to invite us to, we're down.
Yeah, if you could send out some tickets. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. You could bring little baby Edward to the show.
Baby Edward, like he's going to be a baby vampire.
I like watching you sleep.
Oh man, you know, that's a great one. I'm kind of jealous of your pick. Mine's, I guess, kind of a little more sentimental. And I don't get to travel a whole lot. And so the first thing that went to my mind was traveling. So right when I first started dating my wife, my family had already booked a big family trip to Hawaii with like my extended family. My grandma on that side of the family had just recently died. And so it was kind of like a trip that the entire family went to kind of in her honor as well. It was just a fun experience. But I had just started dating her. We had already bought the tickets, so she didn't get to come with me. And at that point, we're like, well, this is, you know, you don't know if the relationship's going to work out and everything. And obviously, clearly it did. So she didn't get to experience it. And I've just never experienced anything like the beauty of like Hawaii. We went to, I forget what the island is called. It's the one that starts with a K. But beautiful. Kauai. Yeah, Kauai. There we go. Thank you. Didn't have enough coffee this morning, apparently. Went to Kauai and it's just a gorgeous like scenery where it's not super touristy there. And I just kept sending her videos and, you know, saying I could wish you could be here and stuff. And so I think one of my like bucket list items would be like bring my family back to that same island so they could experience it the way I did. And that would just be an incredible trip for me.
That's so funny you say that, because I've actually had the very thankfully I used to go to Hawaii for a few. I've been three times.
That's
I got to
right.
go. My mom was dating someone who was from there, so we got to go fairly often for like a family visit trip, but also to do some really cool things. And
wow,
that was like my first trip away from my husband, like when we first started dating. And I've always wanted to take him back there to Hawaii because it's just such a magical, beautiful place.
Okay, so
group trip.
Yeah, I'd say after the baby's born, we're just gonna start. Say we're gonna have a cinema sessions field trip to Hawaii. I'm sure that's in our budget for the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. 2024, let's go.
Who do we need to find to sponsor that trip? Like, hey, sponsor this so we can go to Hawaii.
Ooh, we could do like a Forgetting Sarah Marshall movie because that takes place in Hawaii.
Okay.
Is Point Break in Hawaii or is that California?
I don't know, but Point Break either way would be amazing to cover.
Love Point Break. Great movie.
Oh, I love that. That's a great swing. It's funny about the similarity with the Hawaii timing on our trips. So, all right. So, Kayla, we are talking about A Walk to Remember, and I had not seen this film in 20 years until just rewatching it recently. So could you give us a simple synopsis of A Walk to Remember for those who haven't seen it yet?
Yep. So this film centers on a love story between our character Landon.
The DJ Roomba has finished.
What was that?
That's just my Google Home going off. She likes to let us know.
We have a third co-host on this episode.
Yeah, Roomba. Hey, you know, technology's taken over. So Walk to Remember centers on our two characters. It's a love story between Landon and Jamie. So Landon is a very bad boy, very rough attitude, very like kind of like a rebel rouser, like aggressive, like has a lot of burdens that he's bringing into this. And then Jamie is kind of the opposite. So it's kind of like this battle between light and dark. Jamie is very religious, of the Christian faith, very pious, very dedicated to her church and community and singing, and sees like a lot, like Landon is very short-sighted with things, like tangible and impulsive. And Jamie is a lot more like forethought and thinking of the future. And so we start to see this love story transpire between them both. And then later in the movie, of course, we learn Jamie has a terminal illness. She has cancer and she's going to die, which is kind of becomes like the whole plot of the movie of Landon's trying to help her live out her final days with him together as she passes.
Yeah, it's a very powerful film. And also, you know, before I talk about this movie, before we jump into A Walk to Remember and the plot and our movie talk, I need to speak to you as an audience. I want you to know that I am willing to suffer for you guys at home, in your cars, wherever you're listening. The suffering that I put myself through at night alone in my home at like 11 p.m. after my son's in bed, my wife is tired and she goes to bed. So I'm like, hey, this would be a good time to prep for the show. I don't know how many times on this show I have sat alone on a weekday evening at 11 p.m. and just sobbed my eyes out at some type of sad, crazy movie and just bawling and bawling alone on a Tuesday evening and just going, what has happened to my life? And so I just want you to know, I'm thinking about, they were good tears, but I remember watching Coda 3 days in a row and just crying every night.
Oh, Rick.
I've watched Man Called Otto for this. I cried a lot watching Lion King and now Walk to Remember. Not only did I sob my face off after this movie was over, then I went on this weird 1990s nostalgia trip of like, hey, I remember when Mandy Moore first came out because I was 19 years old. What were the other artists that came out in 1999? Oh, Britney Spears. Let me listen to some of her songs. Oh, here's Jessica Simpson. Let me listen to some of her songs. Christina Aguilera. I'm on this weird rabbit hole, and all of a sudden it's midnight. I'm like, what has happened to my life? I'm sobbing. I'm listening to late 90s pop music. Kayla, this is the suffering that I'm willing to put myself through for our audience.
I think maybe that's like you need to be on both ends of the spectrum kind of thing, though, because I know your love of action movies, as I think true. Everyone who listens to. So like you need the really like masculine, like hard hitting, aggressive energy, but then you need that really feminine, sentimental energy as well. So you're just trying to balance the scales a little bit.
It's true.
I have problems.
I don't know what I need to balance this one out with. I mean, I haven't watched RoboCop in a while. Maybe I need to revisit that one to kind of offset this movie. But Kayla, this is a very, I think the best word to describe it is sappy. It's a mixture of happy and sad.
Yes. Yeah. Cause there's a lot of like, oh, this is so sweet. And then, oh my gosh, I'm bawling.
I just have a lot of feelings.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it is. Let's just jump right into this movie. It's the opening scene. I was starting to take notes, and I just went, what? What is happening?
Yeah. I know. I kind of like blocked that scene out. I feel like when I went to rewatch it, I forgot about it.
So you have this kid who wants to fit in with all the cool kids, which they're not really that cool. They're just like annoying.
They're like the burnout crowd, like I would say.
And so they pick this guy on the diving board and fake him out, so he jumps flat face first into like a body of water that's approximately 2 feet deep. Like, and then the response is, you help him, we're taking off. And then my wife did remind me that someone did actually call the police, but I must have missed that part because I was laughing too hard. So now all of a sudden the police appear and then he goes on this chase, he crashes, and I'm like, well, this is a movie. So ridiculous.
Do they even call the police, or is it like, I can't remember if they called or if like the cops were just nearby and they start to show up.
I feel like they just sensed that something was happening. Like, yeah. We should insert a police car here right now because that feels right.
Yeah. And it's really heavy. It's not like the typical like, oh, like class clown, bad boy. Like this is like
attempted really murder.
Bad stuff that they're. Yeah.
It'd be one thing if it was like a deep pool. There was like a 2 foot body of water and there was just cement right there. And he barely missed hitting the cement.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. But hey, this movie. So I was looking up some things. So we've got Mandy Moore, and this is really interesting. I saw that she was like 17, or she is 16 when it started shooting, about to turn 17.
Oh, wow.
She was really young. I didn't look up Shane West's age, and I kind of just didn't want to because I think he's a lot older. But it was really interesting because I forgot about this. When she debuted her hit song Candy in 1999, which popped right in my head when I was watching this movie, she was only 14.
Wow.
Yeah, I had totally forgot about this because like 20 years later now, she's still in her mid-30s.
I would think she's older given how long she's been around, but if she started that young, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's weird. If you ever pull up that video on YouTube, it's a little uncomfortable because she's 14, but she's trying to act like she's in her 20s. And it's just like, one, she's driving all around. I'm like, you're 14. You don't have a driver's license. And two, she's just, it was, you could tell this was released right after the Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, Jessica Simpson. And all those girls were older. So she's trying to keep up with them and doing this body stuff. It was just a little uncomfortable to watch. I'm missing you like candy. I'm like, no, please stop. Go talk to your mother.
And it's kind of weird that she's in this more like Christian pocket of culture, which I think we had talked about that a little bit before. I don't think she aimed to be like, I think that was just kind of
the
projects that she got. Yeah.
I did read something online. I've read more about this movie than any other movie we've covered. Again, it's a sickness. It's a problem. I don't know what, but I had to do a lot of research afterwards, apparently, while I'm sobbing. Oh, I need to look up top 10 lists. But she apparently, this movie kind of like, she must have been religious at some point or had a Christian faith at some point and kind of didn't like engage in much. But I think I read somewhere that this movie kind of took her back into it after the fact. So it wasn't even like a part of her life during the shooting, but it was kind of interesting where I think that was one of the reasons I remember watching it early on. So it came out in 2002. So I was 22. And just a lot of like our like friends and stuff, or like it was always on like in friends circles, right? Like our youth group stuff. And I was one of the volunteer leaders in the youth group. And so now I remembered because I had forgotten about the aspect of the movie. I was like, why did we always watch this movie? But now I'm like, oh, this movie had that theme. And it's interesting. Like, do you view this as a Christian movie, or do you feel like it's a movie that has like, faith as a part of the plot?
That's a good question. I mean, like, I think that, nowadays there's a very like Christian branded culture with certain films. So I don't think it's like necessarily that. Like, I don't know who funded this movie and all that stuff. That would probably give us a little more insight. But yeah, heavily Christian tones. But also, I mean, even Twilight has some like Christian tones. So like, it just, really? I think it just depends on like, yeah, I mean, like, Edward is a very traditional, like when they talk about like marriage and conservatism and like all those things, like there's a lot of Christian themes in that as well, even though it's like in a fantasy era. So maybe part of it is just like whoever's writing the script has that kind of background. So that's what they're pulling from.
Well, you might know this world better than I do, but one of the things I assumed, but I didn't know this for sure, but good old friend Nicholas Sparks. Uh-huh. Writer, author of all kinds of amazing books that turn into movies. I found this really interesting article on Rotten Tomatoes, just ranking the 9 movies that were adapted from Nicholas Sparks' novels. One piece of trivia. So do you know what kind of his most popular adaptation is?
The Notebook.
The Notebook. That's huge. Mm-hmm. Did you know that none of the movies that were adapted from Nicholas Sparks' movies were ranked fresh on Rotten Tomatoes?
Really? Not even The Notebook?
It's 54% from critics.
Oh my gosh. That is like a beloved, like, my husband loves that movie. He says, he'd probably say that's his favorite romantic movie.
Yeah, I enjoyed that movie as well. It's a good one. But do you know the Rotten Tomatoes score on this movie?
I don't imagine it's very good.
No, I've covered some bad movies. You know, some of our, we talked about some of my nostalgic teen movies, some of the other films. They don't get much worse than the one that we're about to cover. 29% critic score on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, I would guess like in the 40s. That is way lower than I was expecting.
29%. But the good thing is the audience score is 78%.
Okay.
So this has one of the widest gaps, I'd think, of anything that we've even mentioned on this. If we were to do that old segment, Rick's Mediocre Movie, would this qualify?
It might. but I think it was pretty hard to escape this movie. Like, I find it hard. I think at least like probably both of our generations, like, I don't know if I've ever talked to someone who hasn't seen this movie. Like,
it's incredible.
Anecdotally. Yeah.
I had no idea. I mean, it did okay in the box office. I think 40 something million dollars on a budget of only $11 million. I mean, this is like
that's great.
Indie film, basically, it seems like. But yeah, it seems like everyone has seen this movie, which is absolutely crazy. In fact, I just saw, again, insane amounts of YouTube research after this watching. Mandy Moore now has a star on the Walk of Fame.
Oh.
And the two things that they mentioned were This Is Us and A Walk to Remember. I'm like, is that what the criteria is now? to get a star in the Walk of Fame, a really, really sappy, mediocre movie, and then a hit TV show?
I think all you need is an audience, like something that's widely viewed and consumed at this point. I saw, yes. Who was the other one I just saw? I think Zac Efron is getting a star.
Oh, really?
Star. Yeah.
Caleb, maybe if we could get our first bucket list item of watching a movie in Hollywood, like, what about our second? Could we get a star? I mean, you never know who's listening to this podcast. Is there someone out there, right, that says, I like their work, let's give them a star? What do you think?
Yeah. You know, the widely consumed podcast cinema sessions. Let's go.
I mean, if A Walk to Remember can get a star in the Hollywood Fame, we're not that far off. We got to add a little more sappiness to this podcast.
Yeah, maybe we need to put some tearjerker moments, some sappy stories.
I could have a sound drop for it. It's just like this sad type. Actually, I could probably just use the soundtrack from this movie and just introduce.
It's the one that I've tried.
Today, I experienced something really horrible that I want to tell you about. It made me cry. It made me laugh. And I'm here to tell you those stories.
Most podcasts aim to, you know, make people laugh or like shock them, like true crime. But are there really many that make you cry? Maybe that could be our niche audience.
Yeah, this podcast is here to make you cry. Suffer with Rick and Kayla as they explore their deep emotional pains and traumas watching horribly sad movies, which is kind of what I've been doing lately.
I mean, there could be some masochists out there. I think there's an audience for it.
Yeah, I didn't even mention rewatching Spotlight. I mean,
yeah, we've had some heavy hitters recently.
Luckily, when we're recording this, it hasn't released yet. But National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation really is changing the tone. Kayla, Michael and I recorded that. Yeah. You know, you weren't able to make it with us, but we shared some laughs. Definitely an opposite tone of a movie like A Walk to Remember.
Good. We need to break it up. We can only do so much sappy, like very heart-wrenching content.
Is that why you sat that one out? Not because of scheduling issues, but because it was like, this movie's not sad enough for me?
Yeah, maybe I just need to stick to a vibe. I'm like, I got to stay in this zone, right? Like this zone. People talk about the zone of genius, you know, we're expert podcasters, obviously. So I got to stay in this, like, hone the sappy, heartwarming stuff.
I approve. You know, you take me to a place there. Like, you know what, Rick, I'm going to take you into the depths of despair with me. Oh my gosh. So last question I had regarding, it's not necessarily regarding the Rotten Tomatoes song, but or Rotten Tomatoes score, but I wanted to ask you, is A Walk to Remember like the Kayla equivalent of like a Michael Bay movie for Rick?
Ooh, you know, what's funny. Like it's definitely like a nostalgic, like I would say, like it'd probably be on my top list of like most nostalgic, maybe even bordering on like a guilty pleasure type of movie. Mm-hmm. But I don't consume a ton of these movies. Like I do watch a lot of dramas, like indie dramas and stuff, but this is just, I don't know. This movie is like hard to like put in a category. Like it's just
so true.
Different.
Cause there's parts of it I really liked, you know, the mm-hmm. second half of the movie, I'm like, this is really intense. Like the sadness and the story, but there's also parts I'm like, this movie is terrible.
It's so really cheesy. Yeah, some of the dialogue is really cheesy.
My favorite part of this whole movie, I think, is the confrontation. So there's the Photoshop effort, which is funny seeing a 2002 film doing Photoshop. I'm like, oh, it did. It's not just a recent thing. Uh-huh. Where they put her face on the body with the bikini and pass it around. She finds it. And so then Landon confronts that former best friend, and they have that intense showdown. He punches him. And the best friend has this like so late 90s, early 2000s response, like, he has this like weird fist bump. We're over, man. Over.
Yeah.
Over. I'm like, what is going on?
Is that how you communicate with your male friends? Like if you have a disagreement, is that kind of the lingo we're talking?
Yeah, the key is to arch your back and to use your hand in this really assertive way. So like you don't want to present your whole body as intense and like intimidating, like you want to fight all the way, but just your one hand. And then like doing a Texas Longhorns fist with that is really important. It's very intimidating. It's proven to be like, I got you, man. You better walk away. I'm going to come after you. So I
imagine you're trying to instill like scaring someone off with your power. Like I don't need to use my whole body. I can just signal.
Well, the key is this. I'm going to poke you in the eye. Like you punched me in the face, but your left eye is toast if you come one step closer. Like, you will not see for days out of that left eye. I hope it's not your strong eye, because you're really going to be in some trouble.
That's powerful.
That's the level of intimidation that the best friend gives him after he gets punched in the face. Mm-hmm. He doesn't go back after him, because that's too easy. Like, I will take out your eye. Man, maybe he'll even kick him in the groin. Like, he could really take it up a notch.
Yeah.
Kayla, the director on this movie, I was just pulling up his Rotten Tomatoes scores. You know, it's not a Nicholas Sparks level of smoltz, but he's not known for much that's respected by critics, I'll just say. Lots of I'm just scanning through the list, and lots of green, lots of rotten scores here. Cheaper by a Dozen, too. He was the director and executive producer. 6%. The Pacifier, featuring, I think that's the movie with Vin Diesel trying to raise
Vin
a family.
Diesel, yep.
21%. Bringing Down the House. Isn't that like Steve Martin and Queen Latifah?
Yeah. Okay, so a lot of like family, silly vibes. Yep.
The Wedding Planner, 17%.
With J-Lo?
Yep. Okay. Whoa, he took it up a notch here. I didn't realize he's the director of Hairspray. That was a 92% movie.
Hairspray, the movie, okay.
Yeah, the movie. Isn't that John Travolta?
It is, yeah. I don't think it did that well, though.
No, like, no, but it was respected by critics, though. But then he follows it up as the director of a, I don't even know what this is, Bedtime Stories? 27%. He produced Step Up to the Streets.
28%. Oh, the Step Up films.
Step Up 1, 2, 3. Oh, my gosh. 17 again. This guy, he's not who you want to go to for an Oscar film.
Have you seen any of the Step Up films, Rick?
I have not.
They are very cheesy and wonderful.
Well, it fits the tone of this movie.
Yeah.
He's got a wheelhouse. This is his wheelhouse.
He does. I can see the audience. I can see the thread of who would be viewing these movies. Yes.
Kayla, I thought I'd play a fun game with you. This Walk to Remember movie, it destroys your soul. So this is a good trivia question. What scene destroys your soul the most? I've got three options here, but you also have the option of picking an other. So scene number one, the moment that Jamie tells Landon that she has leukemia. Mm-hmm. Scene number two, when Landon says thank you to his dad for paying for her in-home care so she doesn't have to be in the hospital, and that intense cry that he has. Or scene three, the wedding. Which scene destroys your soul the most?
Destroys my soul. Because, like, there are a lot of moments that hit on my soul. I think when she tells him she's sick, like, that is just, like, the pivotal, like, because he's so invested and has done so much good and turned his life around so much at this point. And then you start to realize, this is why she said, don't fall in love with me. That was her number one rule.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's my answer, too. Like, the wedding got me, too. Because you're just replaying your own wedding. You know, I've had some losses in my life and just all that stuff. So that part gets me. I don't know. Now that I think about it, the dad scene destroyed me too.
The dad scene was hard too. And also when, not like soul destroying, but more, I think when I cried the most is when he asked her to marry him. Because you're like, now he has this knowledge of, he knows she's sick. He knows she's going to die. And despite all that, he's like, I still want to be with this person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I want to marry her.
There's not too many movies I've watched recently that you can make a whole checklist of what scene destroys your soul the most. we made an opposite list when we were covering National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation of crazy, weird new holiday traditions, chasing a squirrel, falling off your roof. This list is very different.
Yeah, these are some, maybe this is like a movie I think you could use therapeutically of like, if someone was having trouble crying, you could be like, put this on the list of watch this, and maybe that'll get some of the tears flowing.
Do you think they'd make it far enough to benefit? If you just showed this movie to somebody for the first time today, do you think they'd get far enough?
Yeah, I think that's what's hard about these movies, is because they're so special in our hearts, but if I had like a teenager or someone younger that's like never heard of that movie, don't know what you're talking about, they'd be like, this is so cheesy. It's awful. Like,
did my therapist just recommend I watch a movie where they attempt murder by faking this man to dive into a shallow pool?
What emotion am I supposed to get out of this?
Is this where I'm supposed to start crying, or is it later on in the movie? Kayla, one of the big underrated kind of themes of this movie, is the usage of telescopes. So I didn't do any research on this, unfortunately, but do you think there was a big surge in like people wanting to use telescopes after watching this movie?
I bet there were. That and the, I remember getting the idea of, like, I did get a lot of, like, bucket list ideas, I think, from this movie. Like, when I was that age of, oh, this is really cool. This is interesting. Because I was, like, you said 2002?
Yeah.
I was 9 when this movie came out.
I need I need a bucket list and a telescope. and a husband.
And a husband, yes. But the naming the star thing, too, I bet took off, too, after this.
Well, and the idea, my wife and I talked about it the next day, like the whole standing in two places at once.
Yep.
Was that like romantic or was that cheesy when you watched it? Now you were 9, so it's hard to answer, but.
No, I thought that was cute. Okay. I thought it was really like, because he does that whole night, that whole date where he plans like basically to mark off all these things. And it's just really thoughtful.
What do you think the most romantic thing he does in A Walk to Remember is?
Building the telescope is a big one because that takes a lot of commitment. And also, like, that's when she's really sick and you start to really see the her kind of falling into this illness in that way. So, yeah, kind of like as she's succumbing to this illness, he's still trying to, like, pull out those pieces of her that he knows are so alive.
If you were sick and laying in bed, would it be a romantic gesture, or it'd be an annoyance if someone was out there using a circular saw and all these loud power tools while you're trying to get some rest?
Yeah, I would. There would be some soundproofing involved, I would hope. Like, here's also a gift of headphones and a noise machine and like some of these other things.
Yeah, yeah. I know you're sick and you need some rest. However, I'm going to use very loud tools in your front yard to build a telescope.
I wasn't even thinking about that, but that's so funny.
Romantic gesture, yes. Annoyance, yeah, also sure. Yes.
Yeah.
How do you improvise? This is pre-YouTube. How do you improvise? Like, I'm just going to learn how to make a telescope that's, like, super powered, more than the one she bought at a store, that can see out into the stars so I can see this flying comet. Like, where do you learn how, like, to build, like, a telescope?
Even today, that would be hard with all of the knowledge and information available. But that even more so back then. Like, would take 3 times as long, I'd imagine. He doesn't strike me as super science savvy at this point. So also, like, it's not really working in his wheelhouse.
Right.
To be like, oh, I already know, you know, how this works and how light refracts. And no, so this is really outside of his comfort zone.
Right. Like, the only technical skills or, like, handyman skills they ever show is, like, using the same tool on some unidentified item in the hood of his car. Like, yep. He's got this big old, like, socket wrench kind of thing that he's like, let me just keep twisting this and maybe my car will start working. Was that like the visual setup of, like, now that we know he can work on cars with this one specific tool in this one area of his car, now he can build a telescope?
Yeah, that translates to science equipment, right?
I think same thing. So I jotted that down when I wrote down, like, the therapeutic themes. I was like, I think the primary therapeutic theme of this movie is how to effectively build telescopes.
That's what I took from it. That's what you're supposed to learn, right?
When you are going through a hard time and the girl you loved has been diagnosed with a terminal illness, we all need to learn how to build a telescope just to cope with the pain.
Hey, sometimes you got to throw yourself into a project. I will say that is a handy tip.
Especially if it's one that keeps her up at night and she can't sleep because of it, because they're building it in her front yard. Oh my gosh. Okay, let's transition to our therapeutic themes here. And I wanted to ask you, I didn't have a term for this. So initially I was just thinking, let's just talk about the relationship, but I want to throw out a term to you and see what you think about this. How do you feel about the idea of codependent dating? Because we see in this movie, their first introduction is she sees him, her name is Jamie. So Jamie sees Landon acting like a jerk when forced to tutor this guy after the near-death experience that he causes, right? Mm-hmm. And her first response is I'm going to go be nice to the guy, sit next to him. He's going to be a total jerk to me. And that's how she starts to, like, it's like she starts to fall for him because he needs to be rescued. Did you get that same vibe when watching this movie?
Yeah. Like, which makes sense. She has a very rescuer mentality. Her dad's a pastor, so he's in this very, like, caregiving, helping field. I also wonder if it's, like, a sense of, like, her, like, reclaiming some power, too, of, like, this really aggressive, seemingly popular person, and I am not, but I am going to, like, I have control in this way. Like, so many parts of my life are not in control, but I can kind of, like, I don't want to use the word manipulate. I don't think it's like intentionally like malicious or anything, but I can kind of like control the scenario to some degree of what I need out of this.
Yeah. Cause I was thinking, I was like, so maybe there's a spiritual element to her decision of like, hey, you know, I know I don't have much time left and feel like this guy needs some help and maybe I can come alongside him and kind of help him redeem himself and not planning on like falling in love with him. But that's just the first term I thought about, because like over time you see like he's still kind of a jerk to her owner. Like there's that whole secrecy thing of like, yeah, could you make me my secret friend? Could you help me with my lines in behind the scenes? But then in public, I'm going to make fun of you or ignore you because you're not popular and all my friends want to make fun of you. And yet she has some boundaries, right? But overall, there's not a lot going for this guy that's going to make her want to be with him or be with, to be with him until the play happens and she falls in love with him when singing and they kiss and all that crazy
stuff. Yeah, I feel like, I mean, this is obviously the very cinematic version of this, but like, I definitely come across this in therapy working with clients of like savior complex, savior mentality. I also see a lot of therapists, like clinicians or people in the mental health field or other caregiving fields. So, you know, someone will go into dating and be like, he, she, they have all these red flags. But I'm gonna, you know, just keep kind of like trucking away. And like, I totally get that to a certain degree. Like I did that when I was a teenager with some people, but also like, this is like the very Hollywood great version of how it can work out. I'll say usually this is how it works out, is like someone is very, savior complex, but more like insecure, which she is not insecure, which she really has going for her. She's very strong and resilient. But if you have a really insecure person and then they're going after like a narcissist, manipulative, very aggressive person, that's where that can create a lot of conflict, because you're constantly putting yourself in this rescuer mode. You're enabling them. It becomes sort of like an addiction in some ways.
Yeah. It's like a people addiction. We went into depth quite a bit talking about codependency during the Step Brothers episode. There's a fun episode that you've done. It's not all sadness.
That's true.
Right? So we went into depth in that. So we won't necessarily go into depth on codependency today. If you want to hear more about codependency, go check out the Step Brothers episode. Kayla did an awesome job breaking down a lot of the elements of codependency. But you do see some of those a little bit here. But I think the big difference is she has a good sense of self-worth in this movie. And I think she does do a good job establishing boundaries, which is why he starts to change. Like, I think the visual of that is when he comes back to the house, hey, can you help me with my lines? After he just insulted her in front of the friends by saying, like, in your dreams, which is such a sweet, like, early 2000s. Not as cool as I'm going to get you with my finger this move. But,
the longhorn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're not friends.
Yeah, I think if she wasn't so good with her self-worth and so resilient and strong, this wouldn't work out. And also another reason it works is because he's not in a great place in his life. Like sometimes codependency happens where it's like this person becomes your everything on both sides, but you're leaving these really other good things in your life, like a good support system. Like you're missing out on all these other opportunities for this sole person, but he really didn't have a lot of good to begin with. Both like they kind of hint towards like some family trauma, some disconnection there. And also his friend group is not serving him in any way,
right,
of course. So she kind of pulls him out of that with her sense of self-worth.
Yeah. It's interesting. They definitely allude to a couple of reasons why he's the way he is, but also, so the big focus of the dad situation is his dad left his family, you know, and it looks like he's either remarried or at least dating and living together with this new woman. But you can see there's a lot of wounds that he has that's kind of made him be this rebellious character, which is what makes that moment where like the dad shows back up and helps and they have that emotional moment. But her dad is also, you know, he's the minister of the town, but he's also kind of just a grumpy old man a little bit in a lot of the ways that he's overbearing. He's very protective. He's controlling. And you see then later on, it's like, okay, well, he lost his wife years ago. Mm-hmm. And so now his daughter's sick. So on paper, it makes sense. But one of the questions that went through my head is like, should he still be in a pastor role knowing all of this stuff that he went through and how he's really handling that? Like, is that the best profession to be in? Because that could almost create some of that codependency too of like, I need this to feel good about myself because of the past loss of my wife, now the current like illness of my wife or my daughter, and then now like I need to feel valued by people, need something from me. I almost wonder if there's a little bit of codependency in that pastoral care role as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know it can absolutely be therapeutic and helpful for people to throw, you know, their energy into some sort of like caregiving or volunteering or helpful role, like after losing someone or going through grief or trauma. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe he's not surrounded by a whole lot of people that are, you know, questioning him and building in these reflective questions of, should you be in this role? Like, I know, like in therapy and in clinical mental health, hopefully we have people that are constantly checking in, like, should you be working with this client? Is this, you know, like given your personal kind of trajectory? But I don't know that in these communities, if you're kind of like the upper leadership, we kind of talked about that before, but maybe he doesn't have as many people checking in and this is his sole identity purpose. Mm-hmm.
Something that keeps him going so he doesn't have to focus on those other things. I do like some of the redemption even that the dad has in letting go of control and starting to trust the kid. But I mean, I can't say I would be much different if I was in a position of like, this guy's a legitimate jerk. And for some reason, this is the guy that my daughter is interested in. I'd be pretty protective as well. Maybe I'd take him up to that dock and try to have him jump off into the shallow water and see how he responds.
You definitely see his behavior switch when you start to see, like, he sees that Landon cares for her in the way that he does, like, eventually.
And
that he's not just this bad boy.
Right. Well, and the pivotal scene where he starts to change is the building of the telescope.
Yeah.
So here's the other, I mean, this is the primary therapeutic theme of this film, and it kind of has two aspects of it, right? So anticipatory grief is a major aspect of this film, and also, you know, coping with and accepting a terminal illness. So you see that terminal illness affect people in two ways. So you have her internal sense of grief of like, I'm not going to be around here long, and now I just met this guy I'm actually finding interested in, and I'm really struggling with the idea that I won't be around to see this relationship really play out. And you see, like, how does that grief then affect him? And so I have a lot of thoughts about this kind of stuff, but what did you notice when you first rewatched this film about just that, the idea of anticipatory grief?
Yeah. It's kind of one of those, like, would you want to know questions? Like, yeah, you can do some more planning and some like identifying of values and goals and your future and what you want that to look like in your limited time here on earth. But I think for him, it's even more devastating of, this person helped me turn my life around, and now I'm going to have to know a life without them and hopefully still carry this through.
Yeah.
And not having a supportive group. I mean, it sounds like he kind of finds himself in the church and like builds this community, but we don't really see that outside of her and her father. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I have this very tangible link to like, not only spirituality and like purpose, but like what I want to do with my life. Like, he starts talking about going to medical school and like all these really grand ideas, when before I would guess that he didn't really have a plan for after high school and what that looked like. So she really instilled this sense of longevity. Like, what do I want to do with my life? I have a lot of meaningful things to do, but then to kind of lose, to try to still hold on to that, but like without her in that picture, must be devastating.
Yeah. You mentioned something I didn't really think about in this when watching the movie, because I was thinking about late 1999's pop stars, of course. But, but the idea of how would you process having this knowledge, right? Because we don't often all know when we're going to go, right? But one of the challenges that a terminal illness brings up is now you don't have the exact date or time, but you have this prognosis that's like pretty bleak. Like, I'm thinking about, in grief, there's often this comparison trap of like, what's worse? And it can create a lot of challenges. But one of the things that I've talked to my wife a lot about is like, you know, our moms died very differently. Her mom died of cancer. My mom died suddenly of heart failure. And, you know, they both come with incredibly awful things, and they also have some bright spots, right? So when you're talking about this movie, the terminal diagnosis and seeing somebody decline, there's this suffering that you're watching the person go through, and their physical body's changing and stuff, which is a really hard thing to watch. But there's also some intimacy that it creates, you know? So, whereas the other situation, when someone dies suddenly, you don't necessarily watch them suffer and decline. And there's that element of, you don't even have to be a caretaker for that person, but also the shock of that, yesterday my world included them, now the next day it doesn't, can be so overwhelming for a brain to process that it just is devastating. And you don't get that anticipatory grief element to begin the grieving process before the person is gone, like you do with a terminal illness. And so, you know, if you were in a situation, like, would you rather know when you were going to go, or would you rather be surprised?
That is an impossible question for
me. That's why they pay me the big bucks, Kayla.
Rick, so yeah, I wanted to get your thoughts because you work a lot with grief. So I was kind of curious about, like, when you're working with clients, like, one, have you ever worked with someone who either, like, they were anticipating dying from terminal illness or they had someone close to them was anticipating?
Yeah, I have. You know, I haven't necessarily done, like I haven't worked in a hospice center, so I don't get to often work with the person who's dying up front. Mm-hmm. I have worked with a lot of people who have lost somebody who then themselves are aging or going through some other things, but I have worked with a lot of families that are experiencing that. And a lot of it is, you know, helping them, one, just process the acceptance of this thing. And then two, like, what are some things that you want to say? What are some things that you're feeling? And a lot of it is giving them the space to, like, process. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of, I mean, this, so let me back up for a second. A lot of people in pop culture have heard the phrase, the five stages of grief. You know, we've got, you know, denial and anger and bargaining and depression and acceptance, but we misuse it very often. This is the situation that it was actually created for. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross started this kind of five stages of grief, working with within the hospitals and help, you know, working with people who had been diagnosed with a terminal illness and seeing that this pattern of behavior as someone was trying to process this diagnosis. And so they would individually cope with, you know, we're kind of work through each of these five elements before ultimately accepting the reality of their terminal diagnosis. We've just since kind of misapplied it to, like, giving it to other people and, you know, as, like, this linear, you know, thing that we pass through while grieving. And even though we experience these things along our grief journeys, it creates a false expectation of people of, like, this checklist process of grief. Yeah. But this movie gives you a situation where this is actually how you use it. So I imagine when she was diagnosed with leukemia in this movie, there was a lot of denial. And then there's a lot of anger. I mean, you see some of that anger. She says, I think I'm angry at God. You can tell she's just angry at the situation. The bargaining thing is so powerful when you see that. And people kind of, like, trying to almost negotiate with God or with a higher power or just the circumstances and saying, what if I did this? Maybe it would go away. Or maybe I'd feel better if. And then ultimately the reality of it sinks in. You feel depressed. And then you start to accept it. That I think you see that some in this film, and that's the proper way to use that tool. But I do think that it's still hard because there's so much fear in, like, when you open up your heart more, like he does in this movie, it increases the pain that we're going to feel often after the fact. But the part that people don't think about is if I don't open up my heart and embrace the intimacy that a terminal illness can create, then there's so much often more guilt and regret after the fact. And it's a different form of grief.
When you see people like that have already gone through this, because typically, I mean, we're very lucky if we can see them, you know, when the traumatic incident is happening or the grief, but a lot of times we see these people after the fact, like after they've already, like they're not that grief ever ends or traumatic experience, but like they're not actively in it. Like the person's not actively dying, but it's, you know, they've already passed or, they're kind of wrestling with the aftermath, but what kind of differences in like symptoms or how they're presenting do you notice if they knew it was going to happen versus like a sudden loss?
The big thing is shock. So when someone dies suddenly, it's either often, you know, from a heart attack or something that's really has some stigma to it, like suicide or overdose, the shock that our brain goes into is so different from the anticipatory grief aspect, because it's like your brain can't make sense of this world. And so there's this, everyone responds to that shock differently, but there's a big sense of numbness and like denial that happens because it's like, I can't fathom, like I this doesn't make any sense. So then there's also a lot of visual triggers around the home because they were just using these items yesterday. And all of a sudden the toothbrush and the boots and the clothes and all that stuff, it's like, oh, I see this thing and I'm just flooded with all these memories. With the anticipatory grief, a lot of times, if someone's working through it actively in advance, we're starting to navigate this is going to sound like a cold word, but it's the scientific term. They talk about part of the way that we heal is detaching from our loved one. So it's not in that like building a wall between, but it's almost like a changing of the relationship. So as I'm accepting that someone I love is going to die, I'm embracing the intimacy of the conversations. Is there anything that you want to talk about? Like, you know, here's my memories, you know, like here's things that I want you to know, and just this beautiful conversations if done that way. But there's also the slow easing into of what does this next world look like? Whereas when it's shocking, you don't get that, and your body responds very differently because it's like so disorienting. And it doesn't mean that you don't experience shock and disorienting things when you have anticipatory grief, but it's often reduced. Because there can be shock and anticipatory grief in the sense of, I thought they still had 2 months left, and all of a sudden they declined rapidly. And that can create very shocking, even if you were expecting it. It didn't happen when you were expecting it. So that can create a lot of shock. So that, I think, is the biggest difference. But I think here's the other thing, and it's on the other side. So it's less about the shock part when a sudden loss happens. But one of the things I hear often with anticipatory grief and long-term illnesses is when somebody is a caregiver and invests all this time and energy into supporting somebody, or like in this case with this movie, he's not the one actively caring for her, but he's going above and beyond investing all this extra energy to give her the best life possible at the end. When she dies, there's a couple things that often happens. One, people feel incredibly guilty that they feel relief because they no longer have that caregiving burden. And so they're exhausted by caregiving, even though they chose to do this. When that goes away, they feel relief, and instantly they feel guilty about that. I hear that with almost everybody who was in a caregiving situation for a long period of time. And then the second part is what I talked about, like the guilt and the regret, like the feeling of like, I feel relief, but I feel guilty about it. And so it creates this weird tension that they don't know how to verbalize because they don't know if it's okay to feel that tension. And so normalizing that for people in session is often really important.
Yeah, I'd imagine too. I mean, this is a lot more your world than mine, but like even like what they missed out on might look different of like what they're struggling with. Like, so if it's anticipatory, you know, they're like, I had all this time with them. Some sort of arrangements were probably made of, you know, I'm going to pause work for a little bit and spend time with this person. I'm going to make more of an effort, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's more like a future loss, right? Like all this life that I could have lived with them versus like, if it's a shock, like mm-hmm. I didn't have that time with them. I didn't make time to sit down and be with them. So more like a past grieving and a future grieving kind of difference.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also can happen if someone's illness is scary to me and I can't confront it and mm-hmm. I choose to pull away from the person, it also can create a lot of guilt and remorse and regret, that then people struggle with, because then it's like, now do I jump into the grief process, or do I double down and withdraw even more? And I see that those are the people that don't come to us for help. But I see that, I've known that, and people I've known who've experienced those losses, like, you know, they had a few months left with that person and chose because it was too scary, which makes sense. It's hard. It's a very vulnerable, scary thing to accept someone's, you know, going to leave us. And so they pull away. And then when that person is gone, internally, they still feel that guilt, but they can't face it. They couldn't face it then. It's even harder to face now. And so they double down on the distance and the walls and the lack of connection with other family members. And it makes it really challenging.
Yeah. I think kind of just like, regardless of how you've experienced grief, there's never a bad time to reach out to someone or to get support, because these things can be so longstanding in your life and implicate things in so many ways in your relationships and your work and your just how you're living life in general, that there's probably really not a bad time to seek out support.
Exactly. And then the other thing happens too, like I've talked to people, it's been decades since they lost somebody and they never got help. They suppressed it. And then something happens in their life now that triggers it and takes them back. I met this one guy, it had been 30 plus years, and something they saw on television was so similar to the loss that they had, it triggered it. And all of a sudden they just couldn't function like it had just happened. And so they were really fortunate that their spouse was very supportive and they were able to reach out, but it was, on paper, like, well, this has been 30 plus years. But then when it's like, well, no, this is, I'm just now grieving this now as an adult, even though it happened to me when I was in high school. And so it was that show or that moment that really brought all that stuff back that they hadn't thought about in 30 plus years. And then they got some help and it was really powerful. But sometimes we feel like it's too late and it's never, because that pain doesn't go away. It just waits under the surface and it waits for us to address it. And often if we don't address it, you know, voluntarily, then something else triggers it and it's now more complex to work through later on. Plus it's the pain of the new thing and the old grief that we've buried.
So, Rick, with your experience with our characters, Landon and Jamie, who would you rather work with? Who do you feel like you could make more of a meaningful impact? Like either the person with the terminal illness or the person that knows their partner, their potential spouse, their loved one is going to die from this illness.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. So we're drafting favorite characters to process their demise with, right? No, that's
give me your grief.
Yeah, so because it's these two specific characters, I think I would pick Mandy Moore's character, and I wouldn't necessarily have this knowledge early on, but I could see a hesitancy in Landon wanting to connect with me because of me being a male and his issues with his dad. Long term, I think that could be very therapeutic, but I could see there be some hesitancy there. So selfishly, I also think Mandy Moore's character, because of the where she's at in life, I think that would be a little bit easier. But I think that helping her acknowledge those things would be a more natural fit. What about you? What do you think? Like if you could only choose one of those two characters to kind of come alongside, which situation would you find yourself wanting to be in?
Yeah, I think I would have an easier time working with Landon, just given like my experience and what I find kind of more like natural rhythm, just kind of the anticipatory nature. But also Jamie, Mandy Moore's character, she's like pretty rooted in her identity and her sense of self. And I think I could help Landon with that a lot more of kind of like these versions of himself he lives and like what his values and meaning and purpose of like what he wants to see his life live out to be when he loses Jamie.
So let's transition to like, you know, character kind of case study and how we could come alongside these people. Cause these two characters, are in the movie need help, support. And they find that in each other, which is good. And they both go on this journey. But so you've picked Landon, like what are some things that you think you could do? You started to allude to identity with him. And that's a big source of like, who am I? And kind of all those things. What are some things that you think you would do to try to connect with him and help him if you were seeing him as a client?
Yeah, I think he's got a lot of things. I think one, digging into his past with his dad would be really helpful and kind of how he views men, like just kind of like how his attachments have gone over time of, I don't know if they say like what age he was when dad walked out, but
I'm not sure.
This kind of like, he probably has some abandonment fears. So if he's, you know, fearful and then he finds this crowd that's very, seems very peer pressure driven, he seems to fit in, but like, who knows how authentic that is to how he's being when he's with this group, or if he just kind of landed there of, you know, they made me feel better when my dad left me or however I was feeling. And then this new sense of like spirituality and meaning and like life with Jamie and all these things that I want to do. And okay, so I'm feeling kind of like pulled in these directions and like, where do I want to find myself? What do I value? What do I want to practice and relate to in the world?
Yeah. You know, it would be a challenge I'm thinking through. This is all behind the scenes for those who aren't therapists who are listening to this, but you know, one of the things that we do is to try to like put in order, like what is the priority that I want to work with this person on. So you have these two things. You have the short term, like the person I'm now falling for is dying, but then you also have like a lot of the way I'm handling that is shaped by this abandonment or the way I feel about this with my father. So how would you navigate those two things? Because one plays off of the other, and yet the pressing time sensitive thing is like this anticipatory grief.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a golden way to answer that. I'm kind of like, I kind of take the view of like all trauma and attachment and all these wounds from our past are going to show up in our present and future. So maybe just kind of like pointing out links to, or like being curious about, you know, like about his and Jamie's relationship compared to him and his father, like, and kind of pointing out the differences of like, she's not choosing to leave you, like maybe not that directly, but just like kind of helping him notice some of those inconsistencies and how this loss is going to be different than the loss that he had with his dad.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Cause I think there's also like an affirming that you see, like he's handling this so well that he's, instead of responding like this is another person who's choosing to leave me, he's doubling down and diving into it. So affirming that strength and going like, in spite of what you've been through, and the fear of the abandonment that you might have, affirming that they're actually choosing to double down in the time investment, the love investment that they're making, and you know, as evidenced by like proposing and initiating more things that will incorporate more pain, but doing it out of love, you know, that is a way that even though you might experience more sadness, you're not going to experience as much guilt or regret as a result, which is a powerful thing. That's a tough one.
Yeah,
for sure.
What about with Jamie? How would you kind of start to work with her?
You know, it's tricky because this movie, I think I'd have to work with her prior to the movie, because this movie, she appears like she's accepted her fate. She's accepted this diagnosis.
I
know.
I'm like, Jamie, I don't have a lot of notes with it. Like, honestly, yeah. How she handles her grief is pretty, pretty stellar.
Right. And even him, like working with him at the beginning of the movie, when he tries to murder somebody, is very different from working with him at the end of the movie when he's building telescopes. Right. So, I think for her, a lot of it was, I would like to see the wrestling match. So if I was going to work with her, you know, the wrestling match of that, you know, that of those five stages of navigating the anger of that diagnosis and the shock of that diagnosis. Cause I think she was diagnosed, it was 2 years prior. So I don't remember her age in the movie, but she's probably 18, 17. So 15, 16 or something like that. So when she realized that treatment wasn't going to be effective anymore, that's the point where I'd really want to work with her. In this movie though, I think once she starts to fall for him, you start to see some of that anger come back in the sense of like, why now? Why couldn't I have died before I met this guy? Because now I'm not going to be able to meet him. So that's probably the point where I'd want it to work through. And I'd think help her think through like, okay, so what are some things that you can do now with your, let me back up, accepting their current limitations. Because I think one of the frustrations about an illness like this is you're losing parts of yourself while you're still alive. So accepting their own losses of going like, my capacity has changed. I don't have the same energy level. I have to rest more. So within those limitations, what are some things that you can do to enjoy this relationship? And what are ways that you can love him in the context of that and also set him up for success after you're gone? Mm-hmm. And so coaching her on some of those things and saying like, what are some things that you can do to help him remember you and set him up for that appearance? So receiving his love in the way of like, she could have said, hey, quit making that stupid telescope. It's loud. I want to sleep. But also that's a moment like I'll never forget, let alone he would never forget as a you know, human being. So I think that's one of the things, doing that. And then also I think the spiritual part, like, are you at peace? Like, because faith was so important to her, like, do you feel at peace with God? Do you feel like you've, mm-hmm. you know, do you have any regrets? Do you have anything that you're wrestling with from a spiritual standpoint that we could bring in? Because, you know, I'm not the end all be all on that by any means, right? But having those kind of conversations, inviting, you know, is there somebody, you know, I know your dad's a pastor, but is there someone that outside of your father you'd like to talk to that would be helpful, just because of the uniqueness of that dual relationship that she has with a spiritual figure who's also her father?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because dad might be handling it very differently because he's already lost his wife, and applying some of that instead of an outside perspective.
What's one thing you might say or do with the dad? Because obviously he's been through a lot of loss and now he's coping with this. Is there anything that comes to mind of like, here's how I'd like to come alongside dad? Her dad, I should specify.
Yeah, I don't know how I'd like frame a question, but like, he's putting so much effort and energy into her. Like, I'm pouring so much energy and effort into her. I'd just be curious, like, who's his support network? Like, who, either like when he lost his wife and or now, like, who's really there for him? Who can he go to help uplift him in the midst of struggling with her illness?
Because he does seem pretty isolated. Mm-hmm. And that's a big concern. One thing I noticed before we wrap up here with the church is, I love in these movies where everybody who's ever been a character in the movie all attends the same church.
Yeah.
And it's like the morning after they murder that dude, all the kids are in church the next day and they're panning the crowd. And then even at the wedding, the mom, I'm trying to remember how the order is, but the best friend who tries to poke the dude's eyes out, Landon's eyes out, is sitting next to, in the front row, the mom.
Uh-huh. Like, yeah, they've all made up. It's all great now.
Everything's perfect now. The way they both apologized to him, the non-apology of, hey, I heard about her. Can I help you with this? Sure. That's such a classic guy apology. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was me helping you with this is my way of saying sorry, but I just love that they feature that in this movie.
Yeah, but I have to do some sort of action or offer to help or do something.
Yeah. Kayla, thank you for making me watch this movie again. It's been 20 years, but I had a lot of suffering, and I suffered for you as an audience. Please remember that. However, I also had a lot of fun watching this movie again, which is a weird thing to say.
Would you say it was a walk to remember watching this movie, Rick?
I would say that this movie became my only hope. so true.
I barely touched on the soundtrack, but I will say that is my favorite part of this entire film.
Switchfoot.
Such great music.
I don't remember.
Switchfoot?
I love that band. I remember seeing them in concert, and I remember when I learned that they wrote this song, and it wasn't the main, it was that she sang it. Their version of that song is so good. Soundtrack is amazing.
Their music, and then Dancing in the Moonlight. I also really like that song.
Dancing in the Moonlight, everybody. You know what's the most like 90s edition of this is that New Radicals are on the soundtrack. I remember they had like a one-hit wonder. I want to say it was late 90s, and I saw them on this. I'm like, oh my God, I forgot about the New Radicals. So shout out to the Walk to Remember soundtrack. If you're wanting some nostalgia, go back and check this out. It's such a fun... fun is the weird word to describe it. This movie is torture to your soul and will destroy you, but it's also fun.
It's also heartwarming. It's a very heartwarming film is kind of the sentiment I land on.
Yeah, and if you ever want to learn how to build a telescope in your yard or the yard of someone you love, this gives you a step-by-step blueprint. All you need is a large cardboard tube and a circular saw. That's all you need. I don't think there's any lenses involved. There's maybe a piece of plastic sticking off the side, but this thing will let you see outer space, the comets. Just start with a big cardboard tube. Maybe even like a paper towel roll will get you there. I don't know, but this movie gives you the blueprint.
Get creative.
Kayla, thanks for talking grief. Thanks for talking love, codependent relationships. Thanks for talking telescopes. This was a blast.
It's wonderful, Rick.
And we will see you guys next time on Cinema Sessions.
I like watching you sleep.